Manchester's indie rock and roll station, XS Manchester. The XS Manchester long player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. XS Manchester.
You're right, it's been a while, hasn't it? But the XS long player is back. Not as regular, but still delving deep into some classic indie albums and having a good old natter with some of the people who made those albums. Producers, label bosses, and tonight, frontmen. Because I'm speaking to Stephen Jones from Baby Bird about their classic 1996 album, Ugly Beautiful. I recorded this interview with Stephen when he was about to head out on tour, which you'll hear us talk about, to celebrate 25 years, amazingly, since the release of this album. We talk about what it was like looking back through the years, his huge, unbelievable body of work. I don't think there can be an artist that has released more albums than Stephen, and his relationship with what is undoubtedly Baby Bird's best known song, You're Gorgeous. All that's come on today's XS Long Player. And if this is your first time, the first podcast you've listened to, have a look back through all the other shows, because there's plenty of brilliant interviews with some amazing people in music. So find your favourite album, get stuck in. But this episode is all about Baby Bird and Ugly Beautiful. How you doing, Stephen?
Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you. Nice to talk to you.
25 years since this album was released. Did you know that was it a fact that was circled on your calendar? Did you know it was coming up, or was it a reminder?
I don't have a countdown app or anything like that. Well, at least I don't find it horrifying. I think it's just amazing that I'm still doing stuff. So that's not bad for a career.
Someone shared with me the other day, because I'm a child of the 90s, that was the music genre that I mostly identified with, and someone said that we're further away now in 2022 from 1990 than we were from England winning the World Cup in 1966 in 1990, which kind of puts it in perspective how long ago it was.
I think that as well, like how old I am now from that. It wasn't many years after the end of the Second World War that I was born, so that's quite horrifying.
Well, music doesn't age, let's remember that, and let's focus on this album, Ugly Beautiful, a classic album from the Britpop era. Now, I was looking at this and thinking, this could have been a solo record, because it was written by you. In some cases, all the instruments were played by you. You had a hand in production, I think. So what was it that made it a Baby Bird record rather than it being Stephen Jones?
Yeah, the history of it is that before this album came out, which was the first band album, even though there's tracks on there that I've played everything on, I had 5 lo-fi albums out, the first one was I Was Born a Man, and it was going to end with Dying Happy. So there were 5 albums. They were going to be released over a 9-month period, like a pregnancy. Mm. And it got loads of attention in the Enemy, and I don't know if you remember the Enemy and Sounds and Melody Maker. And they had little top 10 charts, and it went to the top of that. And we just got interest from that. And then this album came out of those. It's probably about 400 songs I had, because I'd been on the dole a long time, so I'd written a lot of songs. And they became those 5 lo-fi albums. Some of those were taken and reworked for this album, plus some other demos that weren't on those, if that makes sense. Convoluted answer, but there you go.
So why Baby Bird rather than Stephen Jones, though? Why was it, let's build a band around me? Was that part of fitting in with the Britpop scene?
Yeah, well, the lo-fi stuff was always under Baby Bird, so that was always my name, just because I wanted it to be a very, very, something that embodied something very simple and very kind of like naive, and that's what those early demos, they were more made on 4-track recorders, so it was very simple stuff. So it was just the obvious thing, because that's what people knew me by, you know, they knew the name Baby Bird, so it was putting a band around these songs, and then Ugly Beautiful comes out on a record label.
400 songs whittled down to 15. You're a prolific songwriter, more, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But how did you make the cut? How did you make the decision of what 15 tunes from your back catalogue were going to make this album?
I think it was just sitting in a pub with Luke Scott, our guitarist, and Rob, who's our drummer, and just drinking 7%. Very thick. I remember it being really thick and brown lager or something. But anyway, no, just sitting around and thinking on the songs that they liked, really, because I'm very easily persuadable. I mean, I like to control the way things are recorded, but in terms of songs, as long as I do like them, it was very much a three-way thing.
So you wrote a lot of this music whilst you were on the dole and unemployed, and then you were picked up by a major. They were backing this album, and it did exceptionally well as well. Top 10 with the album, You're Gorgeous, which is obviously the song that you are probably best known for, went to number 3 in the charts, hung around for 25 weeks or something ridiculous like that as well.
Yeah.
Did it feel like a bit of a whirlwind at the time, kind of that gear change?
Oh, no, totally. I don't think I ever got used to it, really. I'm kind of like back to where I've started now, releasing stuff on Bandcamp, you know, demos. So I'm quite happy where I am now. Yeah, it's not up to you. You're suddenly told what you have to do, where you have to be, which TV show you need to be on. And it's just very, very regimented. And that was, you know, I started in the business quite late on, not as a 16, 17-year-old. So I think it was all a bit of a shock. I just remember sitting, we were in a house that Jimi Hendrix used to use when he came to London. And we were all sat around his table waiting to see what position Gorgeous would be. And I think that's the only clear memory I have, because I hadn't been drinking or anything. And I just remember being told it was number 3. And that was probably the moment where it was the peak.
Did you enjoy being part of that Britpop scene? Because you were very much part of that. You're on TV and Top of the Pops. I'm sure you were doing the Coke-filled, supermodel-filled parties at the time. Did you feel like you belonged?
No, not really. I don't think we were ever Britpop. I think we were at the same time. But I think because we had a big single and it's been regarded in a very pop way, even though you read the lyrics, it's not classic pop music at all. But I think that suddenly pushed us aside of Britpop, and it just made it very difficult to carry on after that, really, because it was such a big song. It's very hard to recover your dignity after such a huge thing. You know, it's a Marmite song. People love it, people don't. So you've got to get beyond that.
Like I said, we'll talk about that very shortly. But I want to talk about your influences in general beforehand, because you cited, or I've heard you cite, Joy Division as an influence previously, which when I read in an interview, I was kind of like, do I hear that? Don't I hear that? But I went back and listened to the album, and 100% there was a few touch points in there for me that kind of compare your stuff, particularly on this album, with Joy Division. I think it's the juxtaposition of the dark subjects and the pop melodies sometimes. Maybe your vocals are a little bit crooning occasionally, which Ian Curtis obviously famously took his crooning style from some Frank Sinatra records that Tony Wilson gave him back in the day. I mean, what do you think are the main influences of Joy Division's work in what you do?
Well, I can't. I mean, it's good that you pointed it out. I find that very hard to judge it, really. I've never grown up playing a guitar or playing other people's songs, you know, on acoustic guitar. So I think hopefully, Baby Bird, whether you like them or not, it's very hard to compare it. But the odd thing, like you're saying about Ian Curtis or even Ian McCulloch, or people that I was, when I was 17, was obsessed by, kind of Bunnymen and Joy Division. But I think the Joy Division thing is melodic bass. And Peter Hook's bass was just totally unique and drove a lot of the songs, I think. And Barney's guitar was sort of on top. And I think that's and when I was in bands before Baby Bird, that's what we would do. I would play the bass and try and play it like a guitar so it was melodic. And I think that's the connection.
I'm going to ask you to pick a couple of songs off this album in a moment that you really like, maybe your favourite songs, but we do need to talk about You're Gorgeous before we do that, which is the song you're most famous for. Yeah. What's your relationship like with this record? Do you love it because of what it did and the doors it opened, or do you resent it because of maybe the attention it gets beyond your other work, your other huge volume of work?
I think at the yes, it's always going to be You're Gorgeous. People will say, Baby Bird, no, I can't remember them, but You're Gorgeous is a door opener for a conversation, especially with my little boys at school. It's like this, oh, he's got that one song, hasn't he? And it lets him show off about that, at least. It's fine, and we always ask when we're doing our small tours, we ask you, did you want us to play the obvious? And they'll either say no, actually, or they'll say yes, but very often they're there to hear the other stuff. But my relationship's fine now. I realise that I've the career, 25 years is happening because of that song, because it pays the bills, for one, and it's still played on the radio. You know, I get alerts from fans saying, oh, you're on Homes Under the Hammer. So it's always there, and it's one of those. I think it's timeless, really. I think we were very careful with the instruments we used to make it not, you know, not to use an 80s synth or something that automatically dates it. So hopefully it's avoided that.
It's a song that's got a certain humour to it, I think. Not to say it's funny per se, but it's got a dark humour to it. And one review I found from the time said it was filling the gap between Bono and Vic Reeves, which I imagine is a pretty big gap. Did you feel, though, that perception of the tune, maybe from its humour, but also from its kind of pop sensibilities, do you think that potentially held you back from being considered a serious artist at the
time? Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of comedians from, you know, I've done stuff with Dom Jolly and Bob Mortimer and, you know, even Vic Reeves, they had songs on their big night out and stuff. Mm. So they've always liked it because of that reason. But I think with You're Gorgeous, there's humour in there, but it's like David Lynch's films. If you're going to put something across which is sinister or a bit nasty or has got something barbed in there, then you need to do that with dark humour or it just becomes shocking. So I think that's why I like You're Gorgeous. And I'll always think, you know, it got into the charts with you. You look at the verses. I mean, it's not your normal standard pop fodder at all. It's actually quite attacking and a little bit nasty.
I mean, it's a weird juxtaposition, isn't it? Because you're right, it feels like a pop song. It sounds like a pop song, but it's got these dark lyrics to it. And I've even heard it weirdly played at people's weddings before, which is very strange. Do you think, I guess that's proof that not everyone gets the narrative of the song. So does that bother you, or are you of the mind that...
No, not at all. I think everyone has to... I get those wedding things where you bring an acoustic guitar for 50 quid and come and play it. obviously not, but if you think of pointing songs, you're on stage and you're kind of, because you're gorgeous and you're pointing at someone in the audience, that's an offensive thing to do because it's a sarcastic song about being gorgeous and trying to flip the tables around. I think I've had people send me just the verses or I've met them after gigs and they recite the verses just to kind of make a point, which is an odd thing to do, but they have done that. So, and people can interpret it any way they like, and it really doesn't bother me if they think it's, you know, pop music is choruses, so you don't always listen to the lyrics.
The other song I wanted to highlight off the album as one of my picks is Too Handsome to Be Homeless, which I'm pretty sure is the only song ever to quote Michael Portillo. And there are a few tracks on this album. Corner Shop as well, I think, has got a bit of social commentary to it.
Yeah,
when you were making this album, were you keen to make a statement with your music, or was it just that you were picking inspiration from the world around you at the time and that happened to be what you saw?
Yeah, both of that. I think I don't want to write an I Love You, You Love Me song ever. Mm. It always has to have another strand to it. No, that sounds pretentious, but I mean, I'm just not interested in doing that, really. I used to do a lot, for 10 years before Baby Bird, I was doing performance art and theatre, so a lot of that was political with a small p, not political like Labour, Conservative, but it was always, I've always wanted to get a point across, you know, to my detriment as well, really. But the song has to work as a song you can sing to. It can't just be a shock thing, you know. It has to have the both elements that go together, so it can be like a lullaby, but there's also words that you kind of swallow and go, did he just say that?
Pick a couple of songs off this album that you really like, Stephen, when you revisited it for this upcoming tour. What really stood out to you?
Well, we always do Good Night, and that was the kind of joke a little bit, because we've started the album with Good Night, but that was where it all started with Mark Radcliffe and Lard and Mark Lamar, and we used to go in and do little sessions in his studio. And Mark actually lives around the corner from me, and I haven't bumped into him yet. I know he's recovering from cancer, but he was the one that started it. We just had such a laugh in his studio, and it was just probably adding up to the idea that Baby Bird a comedy more than music, because it always strayed into that. Good Night was the starting point, and that's why it's at the beginning and also a bit of a joke, because it should come at the end if it's Good Night. And the other one, I'm just looking at the back of it now. Oh, Atomic Soda, because that wasn't a band one. Good Night was played by the band, but Atomic Soda was just a demo that I don't understand why it didn't make it onto those first five lo-fi albums. Hmm. So it was one of those ones that was sort of discovered that we'd forgotten about. And it just sounds very, very different. And it's got like a huge kind of bell sort of sound on it. And I just really like it.
In your head, is there a separation between the stuff that you describe as band tunes and the stuff that is your lo-fi solo stuff from the early days?
Oh no, totally. I think the one downside with this album is that it was had to be put together very, very fast. So we had the singles Goodnight, Candy Girl, Corner Shop, and then things like Bad Shave and I think, and Atomic Soda and You and Me, they were kind of found very, very late. It's quite a long album. It's sort of 18 tracks or something. And there's a track called King Bing, which is on the special edition, which is a 9-minute sort of rant thing. So I think it was probably, we should have thought, right, let's make a 10, 11, 12 track album and cut it down a bit. But, you know, it works if you're prepared to listen to a whole album, which I know people aren't these days.
I mean, you're talking about the four albums you released before this. You have released a ridiculous amount of music. I totted up on Wikipedia 24 albums listed there, but I think it's probably closer to around 100 albums you've released, some self-recorded, some self-released, some put out on Bandcamp, all since 1995. So you're clearly a man who is excited by making new music and a man who wants to look forward in terms of music as well. So with that in mind, how does it feel peering back 25 years to this album, Ugly Beautiful? Do you do it reluctantly, or are you fine with looking back to the past?
Well, it's we've always done stuff off this album anyway, so it's not that new, but it's okay. We will add tracks, which if we can play them, we have to rehearse them first. But so I'm it's quite funny because I don't think I've played Ugly Beautiful, you know, in 1996 or seven, I probably played it, but I haven't played it, you know, until I knew I was doing this interview, because it's I'm just always moving on. I don't ever listen to, it's like actors saying they don't like to look at their films, you know, it's a bit like that really. I like listening to my stuff, but if I can be doing new stuff, that'll be my emphasis.
How does the album stand up to you now, coming back to it 25 years on? Do you think it sounds like it's of the time? Does it sound like it's mid-90s? Or do you think it could be as relevant? I mean, I guess you talk about it being kind of slightly political and tackling issues. A lot of the issues you're tackling are still relevant as today as they were back then. So from that point of view, it works. But how about in terms of sonically?
Well, that's scary, what you just said there, yeah, especially homeless. You know, it's still nothing's changed in that department. So sonically, it's interesting because it was done with a guy called Steve Power, who did Robbie Williams and Bon Jovi, I think. So a very strange mix. But it was our first experience of a producer. And I was always told, it's always been one of these things in my head, like my dad saying to me, you need to get a proper job, which is always in my head when I'm lying. If I'm having a lie in, I should get up and get a proper job, not music. And he was a bit, it was interesting. And also, you're always told you need a producer. Name me an album, a classic album that doesn't have a great producer. And I know that's kind of true, but I also think that you can do that yourself and you don't need a producer. So I get very confused anyway, whether my ears are pretty rubbish anyway, so I probably need a producer, and people would tell me that. So, but it was an experience with a producer, and we had to fit into that. And that was my first experience of someone being in charge that wasn't me, which I took well, I think. I dealt with it okay. I'm sure the band would say I was an ass, but who knows?
Stephen, I really enjoyed rediscovering this album, Ugly Beautiful. It's a stunning album right the way through. There's some real gems of music on there as well. I'm sure everyone at the Deaf Institute on the 24th of February are going to enjoy rediscovering it as well. Normally I finish off these interviews by asking about new music, but it seems that you're always working on new music and you've always got stuff in the pipeline. So what is next for you? Do you have kind of big picture ambitions, or is it just you want to carry on making music and enjoying what you're doing?
I think I've just been really lucky because obviously Gorgeous financially has kept me going. And also, name drop. I did two albums in LA with Johnny Depp and his producer friend, Bruce. So things have always, I'm only name dropping that because things always come along at the right time to take the pressure off me doing interviews and talking about Gorgeous. So I got to talk about that for a couple of years, and that 5 years, actually, I think we did that, and he made a video, and fantastic. So those are the things that keep me going. I think I'm really quite lazy. I just work in bursts, but it's when things come along, and at the moment, the new thing is there's a guy who's doing, wants to put some of my stuff out on a eco-friendly vinyl, which I was quite shocked to hear. A lot of people throw their vinyl away. I thought they'd end up in Oxfam shops or they'd keep them in the garages, but a lot of it goes to landfill. So he's doing this thing which will be recyclable, and it's all different colours. Mine's going to be white, but there's a series of four artists and he's doing that. So these things come along is all I'm trying to get to. And those are the things that spur me on and mean that I can carry on. You know, I've got to provide for my family as well. So I need to, all these things are there.
Stephen, great to talk to you. Good luck with the tour.
Thank you.
The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. Excess Manchester.
Nice one for listening. Cheers to your ears. Thanks for your time on today's XS Manchester Long Player. Appreciate you listening to this show, and what a nice bloke Stephen was. I do remember he was talking about working with Johnny Depp in that interview. I do remember I was working at a radio station at the time when he was making that album with Johnny Depp, and I can't quite remember the story, but somehow he came into our studio to record a session with Johnny Depp's musicians, so with his band, and they were a few of the coolest people and nicest people I think I've ever met. Anyway, that is it for today's podcast. Do check out the other episodes in this series. We talk about, to pick a few albums off the top of my head, Ocean Colour Scene, Mosley Shoals, Oasis, Definitely Maybe, Liam Frost, Show Me How the Spectres Dance, which might not be an album you're instantly familiar with, but is one of my favourite interviews because it's an album I absolutely love. So have a look at the list of albums we've covered, find your favourite albums and get stuck in, and I will be back soon with another XS Long Player.
Another XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. XS Manchester.